Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and editor Simon Lambert today is assistant personal finance editor Helen Crane. And coming up, home ownership among the young has nearly halved since the 1980s, yet house prices continue to soar, making raising a deposit seem impossible for many. So how can you do it, and do it quickly, without the bank of mum and dad? Could plans to make things better by relaxing mortgage affordability checks actually end up making the situation worse? Also today, Ofgem gets blasted over the energy supplier Domino's, which has left us with a multi-billion pound bill. Could a savings platform help boost your rate and beat the banks? And Christmas gift inflation. Nothing is safe. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, UK house prices continue to power on, fueled by high demand for limited supply, low mortgage rates, and a strong labour market. November's figures show prices registered their strongest three-month growth in 15 years. At the same time, home ownership among the young has halved since the 80s, and not out of choice. Now, while two-thirds of parents have helped their kids get on the property ladder, not everyone has the bank of mum and dad to draw from. So if that is you, what hope is there? Any at all? Helen, what's happening with house prices? Is it ever going to stop?
Sure. So you're right in saying that over the last about a year and a half since the housing market opened up following the first national lockdown, house prices have gone absolutely crazy. So at some point, the year-on-year figure was around 11%. So that's £20,000 plus in a year on the average home. So huge increases. And unsurprisingly, you know, your house price has been going up for a long time, but it's really kind of turbocharged in the last year or so. So that means that in the long term, now many fewer young people are able to get on housing ladder than they were basically in the last generation. So sort of Generation X's in the 1980s, 51% of those people owned a home in 1989. So that's 25 to 34-year-olds. This is according to a report by the think tank, the Resolution Foundation. That fell to a low in 2016 of just 25%. It's now ticked up slightly. So 28% of people in that age bracket have got on the housing ladder. That is basically because they don't earn enough and they don't have enough savings.
Is it just that? Just to throw a spanner into the works here. I don't know. I've not checked. But are more people wanting to, dare I say it, women as well, have a career? People who are single wanting to perhaps live alone, and it's much more expensive, obviously, to raise a deposit when you're on your own. Are there other elements, do you think? Just anecdotally, I'm not asking you for some hard stats here, Helen, but I sense that there are other issues at play here. Is it all bad news because this job opportunity, people wanting to move around, actually don't want to settle down in one place much anymore when you're young?
Yeah, I think it's partly because of that. I think the issue about single people is definitely right. I mean, but that's a financial thing as well. You know, if you just have one salary, it's much harder to raise a deposit and also to get approved for a mortgage if you just have one salary. So, of course, you can normally only borrow 4.5 times your wage. So if you're a person, you know, earning the average salary, which is about, I think, £27,000, it's not going to get you very far when it comes to buying a flat. I think for certain people it is a choice. Maybe people in the sort of younger end of that bracket, you know, sort of 25 to 30 year olds now, maybe aren't always as interested in buying a home as they were, you know, sort of 30 years ago. But I think, you know, I'm in my mid-30s, and I think most people I know would like to buy a home if they could. And I think the report also, it said that of the people who did have the means to buy a home, only 4% had chosen not to do it. So I think very much people who can do it still will do it. You know, of course, there's a few exceptions. But I think, you know, there's this idea that, you know, younger people love to rent now and they want to have these sort of flexible lives. And I think that's maybe a bit kind of a bit over-egged by perhaps older people who are, you know, quite comfortable in their own housing situation.
All right, Simon, you're sitting there smug on your soft, comfy sofa in your comfy house that you comfortably own.
It's not entirely correct. And this is going to be entirely lost on any of our listeners, but I'm not actually sitting on the sofa. my chair has a sofa behind it. And so it looks like I'm sitting on a sofa. I'm actually sitting on a chair. Some people have artfully considered bookcases as their backdrop. I've just got a backdrop that makes me look like I'm sitting on a sofa. Yeah, nice. Maybe I need to get some kind of green screen behind me or something. Yeah, I am sitting here in my own house. And when you think about it, you think how lucky you are to be doing that and how impossible it would be for me to be sat here in this house if I hadn't have started on the property ladder relatively early. I have friends who are the exact same age as me, you know, equally successful, etc., who got on the property ladder 3 or 4 years later, and that has made a colossal difference to them. You know, they're a rung down, that's a big jump. And also, if they're single, that makes a huge difference. And I think that's one of the important things that you guys just mentioned, is people who were single. It's actually that if you go back not so long ago, it would be perfectly normal to be able to buy a property by yourself. And that is something that has been all but eradicated through the 2000s, basically pretty much since the turn of the millennium. It is now very, very, very difficult for people to do that. So, I mean, if you look at the numbers, the average house price, according to Halifax, is £273,000, right? So it's different according to different people, but the direction of travel is all the same. House price is going up by a lot. That's gone up by nearly £21,000 over the last year. So pity the poor first-time buyer saving a deposit and watching house prices get more expensive at the rate of £1,700 a month. Now, obviously, they're not going to need to save that whole £1,700 because you borrow money. But even if you were only saving the 10% deposit element of that house price and the increase in the house price, that's a lot of money. So 10% of that, £27,300. Okay, if you could get that. As Helen said, that's pretty much the pre-tax median full-time salary in the UK. So you'd have to save an entire year's worth of wages. Problematically, even if you could save such a large sum on your own, you'd then need to borrow £245,693 on a mortgage. That's going very precise on the £27,299 and the exact house price. Okay, so you're going to have to borrow about £246,000 on a mortgage. Even if you could find a bank or building society that would lend you five times your salary, which you can do, but it's not so easy, as an individual, you'd need to earn just under £50,000 a year to qualify for that. So that illustrates that the difficulty is that if you were a first-time buyer trying to buy the average home, raising a 10% deposit on it, you'd need 50 grand just to get the mortgage, you know. So, and most first-time buyers are not earning 50 grand, which is why most people tend to buy either with a partner or perhaps sometimes in lesser cases, they'll buy with a friend or with someone else. And that's only the average number. Now, obviously, there's lots of places in the country where house prices are lower than that, but you'll tend to find that wages will tend to be lower. So maybe you're less likely to be earning £27,000. You're definitely less likely to be earning 50. And if you happen to live in somewhere like London, where the average property price is £515,000, you'd need £51,500 for a 10% deposit and the ability to borrow £464,000 on a mortgage. And you're going to need to be earning a lot of money to get a £464,000 mortgage. So, I mean, those sums illustrate why first-time buyers, you know, are A, often couples or friends, and even then they need help and regularly need this help from the bank of mum and dad. And I think that whilst there may be some people making a lifestyle choice to rent, I don't think that there's enough of that lifestyle choice going on to explain why people are buying homes so much later and how much harder it is for them. I think the thing that explains it is that they are so expensive, and it's raising the deposit that's the really difficult thing, because for many people, due to low interest rates on mortgages, they would find themselves in a position where if they did own the property, they'd be paying less a month on the mortgage than they would be doing in rent. And that's the thing I think that really annoys a lot of people, is that I could be paying a mortgage for less and buying my own home rather than paying the money to a landlord.
No, exactly. I'll tell you what, annoys me, Helen, often is, you know, when you read these articles, not in This Is Money, I'd like to point out, that say, I drank water and ate bread for a year and saved all this money. And then when you actually read the article, they got a load of money from the bank of mum and dad to buy a deposit. That's not inspiring at all, is it?
No, my favourite ones are the ones where I managed to buy my first home without having to give up holidays by super saving. And it turns out that they moved back in with their mum and dad, and then the mum and dad gave them 50 grand.
Exactly. I mean, exactly right. Yeah, sorry, I missed that one. The ones that then moved back in with the mum and dad, but I've perhaps got more sympathy for them. Helen, is it possible? You know, with all of what we've said, these huge deposits, the house prices rising at exponential, it looks like, rates at the minute, it is quite depressing, can I say, if you're hoping to buy a property?
Yeah, it's very difficult. And I will say, especially when I was in my 20s, almost everyone I knew, I live in London, and almost everyone I knew who managed to buy had either had a big chunk of help from their parents, had a sort of lucky inheritance, or you know, happened to have a much more well-paid than average job. You know, it's hard. I think one thing that's been helpful to me, and I think other people that I know, is managed to save a lot during lockdown. You know, obviously you would never wish for the pandemic, but I think, you know, I managed to save probably double what I would be able to in an average year last year, which has given me a bit of a boost. But obviously not everyone would be able to do that. So it's, you know, it's still very difficult, but there are, you know, there are things you can do to help. Simon mentioned in a piece this week about lifetime ISAs, which are, you know, they're not going to take your savings to kind of astronomical levels, but they can give you a little bit of help that might just kind of push you over the edge to get that deposit. So yeah, it's extremely difficult, but it can be done. It can be done.
Thank you, Helen. I feel bolstered now. Simon, so saving for a deposit, you've written an article about, should you save in cash? Should you invest? Is a lifetime ISA worth it?
Yeah, I mean, and starting off with the question of, like, how long would it take you to save £27,000, which is that 10% deposit on the average home. Now, not obviously people aren't buying the average home, but let's just use that number. It's a lot of money to try and save. And in all honesty, right, if you are earning that median salary of £27,000 a year, your take-home pay is about £1,800. If you could save £200 a month, you'd be doing reasonably well. I mean, that's not super, super, super saving. But once you factor, if you're renting somewhere and you've got rent, you've got bills, you've got your household expenses, you've got commuting costs, and then you need to allocate yourself some money for enjoying your life, you'd be doing quite well to save £200 a month at the end of it. If you could save £200 a month, and you used Nationwide's regular saver, which is currently one of the best regular saver sort of rates on the market, it would take about 10 years and 4 months to save all of that money up to get that whole deposit. Now, if you were only saving at the average, the best instant access rate, it would take you about 11 years to get that money, which is quite a long time. So the question is, like, well, should you invest instead? To which you could do, but even if you got an average annual 7% return, which is above the medium term return from the FTSE All Share over recent years, it would take you 8 years and 9 months. Now, that is the kind of lengthy period that qualifies for investing. They normally say, like, more than 5 years is the usual advice. But the problem is that by taking that extra risk with your money to get the extra reward, you run the risk that in the final years of your saving, or maybe just even as you are about to get that deposit and you need it, something goes wrong, stock market crashes, and you lose 10, 20 or 30% of your hard saved deposit. So that's one of the things people need to think about. What makes a bigger difference is if you can set aside more money each month. So if you could up that £200 to £300, in the savings example, it would take it down to 7 years and 5 months instead of almost 11. And with the investing example, it would take it down to 6 years and 2 months. But I mean, that's still long enough to make most first-time buyers despair. You know, 6 years and 2 months, It's a long time to be saving for. But, you know, the good thing is that people's wages should go up over that period. They might find they can save more money, put more aside. If there is the opportunity to do something like move back in with parents, so that you slash your expenses and maybe pay them a small nominal amount of rent and then do some super saving for a year or so, then that can make a huge difference. Helen mentioned the whole lockdown savings phenomenon, where people realized that they weren't spending anywhere near as much money because they couldn't do anything, and suddenly super saved for a year and built up nice balances, which is great. But I think that phenomenon has passed now. Most people are back to struggling to make ends meet at the end of the month and wondering where all their money goes. But if you could take that money, put it into an account, and then build up on top of it, it makes a difference. But the one thing that does make a big difference is the much maligned lifetime ISA. Now, the lifetime ISA is a product that's come in for lots and lots of criticism because it combines saving for a home and saving for retirement. And those two things are separate endeavors, really, in most people's eyes. And people might not put money into a pension because of it. They might miss out on employer contributions and all these issues. But if you just take it as the vehicle for saving for your first home, then it's a bit of a no-brainer, to be honest, because the government will top up the money that you put in by 25% up to £4,000 a year. So they'll give you a maximum bonus per year of £1,000. There aren't many places you can get a guaranteed 25% return on your money, apart from a lifetime ISA and paying some money into a pension. I can't really think of any, actually. And if you qualify, you're right, you need to be under 40. You need to use it as to pay for your first home. You can't have owned a property anywhere in the world before. And there's some other qualifying criteria. But if you meet all of those, then it's well worth doing, because it will turbocharge your savings to a certain extent. And it will definitely get you to that number that you need to get to as quick as possible. And there's also some other tricks that, if you can get a bit of money from the bank of mum and dad, for example, if they say to you, look, I'm sorry, I'm not in the kind of position that some people are in to hand their children tens of thousands of pounds to help them with a deposit, I can maybe give you £1,000 or a couple of £1,000. Get that into your lifetime ISA, get the booster on it, and then pay your money in on top. Get the growth compounding. And maybe you can opt for two different kinds of lifetime ISA. You can take cash, you can do stocks and shares. The cash is the safer option, because you're not taking that risk that I was talking about earlier. But if you're willing to take a bit of that risk and you're going to go, okay, all right, well, you know, I can risk the potential for a fall in order to get that higher return, then that can make a real difference. But do think very carefully about it and have your rainy day fund built up somewhere else before you start doing this, because you cannot take money out of that lifetime ISA for any other reason than buying a first home, or you have to wait until you're 60 without getting a hefty penalty on the cash.
I'm a big fan. I opened one a few years ago. Yes, I am under 40. And I agree with you. I just thought, well, I'll open it up. I haven't got a house. Let's see where it goes. You know, I'm just looking here at some of the figures I've got in. I don't mind saying 14,000 I've put in, 2,000 in investment gains. And as Simon says, do be wary about if you're using it for the short term. Lifetime ISA bonus, about 3,500. So look, everyone's a winner. That's £5,500 that I didn't put in that it's grown by.
Yeah, and that makes a huge difference. That bonus element that you just said there, you know, that makes a really, really big difference. So yeah, if you qualify and you're not going to need to take the money out early and you're going to use it to buy a home, then I do think that if you are trying to save for a deposit, or if you have children who are trying to save for a deposit, if you listen to this and you've got kids who are trying to save for a deposit, the lifetime ISA, probably a bit of a no-brainer, even though we quite often talk about it in not particularly favourable terms on this podcast.
We've spoken a lot about raising deposit being very hard, yes, but once you've got the deposit, when you mortgage rules that were brought in, affordability checks, another one of the stumbling blocks for young people to get on the property ladder. Well, the Bank of England is considering relaxing those to make it easier to borrow. The tests were brought in, of course, if you remember, after the financial crisis to avoid another housing bubble. As you can imagine, Helen, the proposals are not without their critics. What are the plans?
Sure. So the Bank of England is doing a review into mortgages and mortgage affordability, basically. So the kind of things they're looking at is like you said, those rules that were brought in post-financial crisis to kind of tighten up mortgage borrowing and make sure that we didn't get to a situation where a lot of people were taking out mortgages that they ultimately couldn't afford. So it's things like checking that people could pay a much higher interest rate if interest rates were to rise. So at the minute, if you apply for a mortgage, part of the checks that you have to go through are to do with something called a reversion rate. So you have to prove to your lender that you could, if your fixed term came to an end and interest rates rose, you need to prove that you could pay the lender's standard variable rate, which is the kind of default rate that borrowers drop onto when their fixed term ends, plus usually another 3%. So you're essentially having to prove to them that you could pay a lot more on your mortgage payments each month if the financial situation in the country changed.
Right. Why are they thinking of getting rid of it, Simon?
Because it's a stumbling block for people trying to buy a home. And also it's a little bit unrealistic because the rates that they're stress testing people on are not rates that people are envisaged paying. They don't reflect the low, super low interest rates that we've got. They don't reflect the fact that most people would remortgage at the end and so on. I mean, you do have to bear in mind that actually the financial crisis, the credit crunch, came about from people not being able to remortgage at the end, led to believe that they would be able to remortgage at the end and it wouldn't be a problem. And then all of a sudden they got to the end of their deals and they couldn't remortgage. Now, in the most extreme examples in America, this was because people had no income and various other reasons. But there was a credit crunch in the UK as well that hit mortgage borrowers who were on two-year fixes, got to the end of their two-year fixes, suddenly discovered half of the mortgage market had been pulled, and ended up on much more expensive standard variable rates. Now, we dodged a bullet there because ours was kind of delayed a bit from the US one, and the Bank of England started slashing interest rates, which then pulled down standard variable rate on mortgages and pulled down those reversion rates that people were being hit with. But there were lots of people who suddenly discovered that they couldn't get a new two-year fix just as they thought they could and had been told they could by their broker in the past. So they are there for a reason, but they are considered a bit unrealistic. The issue is, what would this enable people to do? Borrow more money. This is putting a cap on how much people can borrow. What happens if people can borrow more money? House prices keep going up even further. We repeatedly hear this mantra of we must build more homes, we must build more homes, we must build more homes. In all reality, it's not a shortage of homes that's causing high house prices. It's decades of cheap and easy mortgage credit, which allows people to keep paying higher and higher prices. Had we just left the market to correct itself, then house prices wouldn't be as expensive as they are now. But we have artificially put boosters under it every time it looks like, you know, falling back towards fair value. And it's difficult to see what could give it another big leg up. But easing mortgage rules is definitely one of those things. I think that we will see an easing of mortgage rules. I think we will see a final leg up for house prices before they come tumbling down. And I think one of the things that's going to come into play within this, again, is like the return of some kind of interest-only element that allows people to borrow substantially more because those monthly payments suddenly become much more affordable. But the problem is that they're not paying back the loan. They're just paying the interest. But I think they need to be a bit careful on this one, because whilst it seems like a good thing to do to let people borrow more money so they can get that home that we were just talking about, it has the potential on a larger scale to backfire and just end up making homes even more expensive.
Yeah, I think that's interesting that you mentioned the perhaps a return to more interest-only mortgages, which just seems kind of slightly terrifying. I think having seen people still today who are on interest-only mortgages they took out sort of pre-financial crisis, you know, when you come to the end of that mortgage, you know, ultimately if you can't pay it back you have to sell your home. It's you know, it would be great if it became easier to qualify for a mortgage, you know, especially for the first-time buyers, take away some of those barriers. That would be great. And it seems on the surface fair to bring those affordability checks down in line with sort of today's reality. But if that's going to just bring up house prices, then I mean, it's a chicken and egg scenario, isn't it? It's sure, it's easier to qualify, but then house prices are more expensive. It kind of seems like it's not necessarily a real solution.
First time buyers listening must be like, oh my God, how high can they go? Don't ask that question. Talking of savings, now we don't need to go over old ground. Savings rates are rubbish. We know that. Inflation rate is a real kicker for savers. Most of our collective cash, though, is swilling around in poor paying, easy access deals, potentially dishing out as little as 0.01% interest. If you are trying to buy a house, suggest you might take a look at that. So could a savings platform help boost your rate and beat the banks? Helen, what's this?
Sure. So as you said, savings rates have been pitiful in the last year or so. One way that you can kind of not exactly get around that, but you can get yourself a little bit of a bonus is by signing up to a savings platform. So these are basically websites where you can sort of manage your savings pot, and they will do things like show you the best accounts to put things in and perhaps sort of move your savings around so you can keep getting the best rate without having to do as much of the admin yourself. So Raisin, Aviva Save are examples of those. And the nice thing about them is, as well as sort of cutting down on that admin for you, they also sometimes offer nice little bonuses for signing up with them. So both of the ones that I've just mentioned offer £50, which isn't a huge amount, but if you look at how much you would be making as a return on the average savings account, and if you add that bonus into that, that can actually effectively mean you're getting a much better rate than you would be by just dumping your savings in an easy access account.
So it's don't get too excited, but Simon?
Yeah, I mean, don't get too excited. But if you put, for example, with Raisin, if you put £10,000 in, you can unlock a 1.11% rate on easy access versus 0.75% without. And that's because of this bonus that you are getting when you pay your money in. And it has the effective, it's the equivalent of bumping up that rate to a higher figure. But there is, another great advantage of these savings platforms for people who have large amounts in savings. And that is that it's easy for people to lose track of them. They end up in legacy accounts paying 0.01%, those ones that the banks love to inflict on us, rather than just paying us zero, which would be a more honest and fair way to do things. And that's the really damaging bit. And if you've got your money in one place where you can see it and you can manage it in one place, then I think you're much less likely to end up in that scenario. Now, you might find that if you sign up to a savings platform, Raisin, Hargreaves Lansdown Active Savings, there's another one called Flagstone, AJ Bell has one as well, Aviva has one too. Aviva's offering a bonus at the moment as well. I don't think that's run out quite yet. You sign up to one of those, then you will be able to just go in, see where all your money is. You won't get the absolute best rates, but you're going to get near to the best rates on the market. And the amount that you'll lose versus the absolute best rate is quite minimal. And it's definitely better to forego that than it is to have tens of thousands of pounds sat on a 0.01% rate. It should be said, however, that if you do have tens of thousands of pounds in a savings account, you might want that you do not need in the immediate near future in its entirety. Yeah. You might want to consider investing that money for a better return. Because, for example, you opt for something like a dividend paying investment trust, an UK income investment trust, you could be getting a 4% dividend return and the potential for capital growth. And some of them, if you opt for one of the dividend heroes, the investment trusts that have raised their dividends year in, year out for the longest possible time, going back 50 years, they're probably not going to cut that dividend anytime soon. Now, you need to be aware that you're foregoing investing for capital growth and share price return. But if you're a more cautious saver who's got tens of thousands of pounds sitting in accounts paying less than 1%, then maybe it's worth considering something like that.
All right, then. Now, you might wonder, and perhaps fairly, I'd suggest, with the game of dominoes that appears to be going on with energy providers at the moment, what the heck has the regulator been up to that we're in this situation? A new report claims a catalogue of errors at Ofgem has left consumers with a multi-billion pound bill. Helen, give us some context. No one can fail to notice, even if you were not among the millions of people whose energy provider has just gone kaput, that something is amiss in the market, shall I say?
Sure. So this energy price crisis that's been going on for the last few months, it's because of rises in the prices of wholesale gas. And as we all know, it's left plenty of suppliers going under, customers being left without a supplier and being moved on to another one, bills going up astronomically. It's not a good situation. So the regulator of the energy market, Ofgem, has come in for some quite harsh criticism from Citizens Advice, the sort of consumer champion charity. They have said that the regulator has failed to act against unfit energy suppliers, and not just recently, it says they've been doing that for more than a decade, and that's left people basically vulnerable to the situation that's happened now. They're essentially saying that there's been kind of missed opportunities, and that if Ofgem had kind of acted earlier, this situation we're in now could have been avoided.
Simon, what have Ofgem said in response? And do you have a degree of sympathy for the regulator here? I mean, is it a bit unfair what Citizens Advice has suggested?
Do I have a degree of sympathy? I have a small degree of sympathy in that the energy industry has been blindsided, as have the rest of us, by something unexpected occurring, which is this insane spike in energy, gas and electricity energy prices. The evidence that it has been blindsided by this, and that we have also been blindsided by this, is the sheer number of suppliers that have failed. We're well into double digits. We're above 20 energy suppliers that have failed this year. And clearly they weren't expecting that, because if they were expecting that, they would have actually done something about it in advance. And the evidence that we as consumers have been blindsided by it is the fact that most of us didn't lock ourselves into really, really long-term fixed energy deals and are staring down the barrel of either our prices rising rapidly now or them rising rapidly in the near future when we come off whatever fixed energy deal we're on. But Ofgem's own analysis showed suppliers held a total of 1.4 billion in surplus credit in 2018. This was used as evidence by Citizens Advice that a number of suppliers were reliant on this money, because it was like, why are they holding on to so much of customers' money rather than returning it to them? And Ofgem says it has helped protect customers with its supplier of last resort scheme, where consumers with providers that have collapsed are automatically moved on to another supplier. And a spokesman said, Ofgem's top priority is to protect energy consumers, and we understand the challenges households and businesses are facing in light of the unprecedented increase in global gas prices. Ofgem's safety net has protected more than 4 million customers, moving them to new suppliers, ensuring they don't need to worry about their energy supply, and protecting their credit balances. In addition, the price cap is protecting millions more from the full impact of high gas prices this winter. However, we accept that the energy market needs reform, and quickly. The current system was not designed for this sort of extreme market event. Building on the approach we set out in October at Energy UK and our subsequent open letter to the industry in the next few weeks, we'll be announcing changes that will demonstrate the seriousness with which we are tackling the pace of change needed, the concerns around the financial resilience of the market, as well as ensuring that fair prices are reflected through the price cap. We welcome the opportunity to work alongside all consumer groups, including Citizens Advice, as well as the government and the energy industry, to make the changes needed, as we all share the same objective to protect energy customers now and in the future. My only issue with that is if you talk to people in the energy industry in the know, that they will tell you that this was a disaster waiting to happen. So don't talk to the people who were running the Mickey Mouse energy companies, because they'll defend themselves. Talk to the people who weren't running Mickey Mouse energy companies, and they'll say, look, this was clearly a problem. There was this mushrooming of energy companies. Every man and his dog was setting up an energy company. And I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if there was one called A Man and His Dog Energy. And maybe there was a rival set up called A Woman and Her Dog Energy. And they were making very, very small amounts of money, if any. It was very, very low margin. They weren't really an energy firm. They were connecting customer A here with energy supply over here at point B, acting as a middleman. They didn't have some of the same supplier costs that some of the big boys had, so they could compete very aggressively on price. And what they would do to pull in customers is compete so aggressively on price, they'd get to the top of the best buy tables and suck in all those people. But they had no financial resilience whatsoever. And yes, this was an extreme market event. Okay, so I've already said I have an absolute huge degree of sympathy there, extreme market event. But even a much less extreme market event, and even arguably just normal market conditions, these were not really fit for purpose energy suppliers. And I hate that fit for purpose term, but I think it is one of those instances where it does work. So in a sense, you've got big ones like Bulb that have gone, you know. Now, I think Bulb was probably doing a better job and more should have been more financially resilient. Bulb can probably blame the extreme market conditions, but A Man and His Dog Energy was just a badly run business. And you have to wonder what the plan was. I think the plan was just like scoop up a load of customers and either get so many that you eventually make some money on those teeny tiny margins. Or I think maybe it was just one of these scoop ups from customers and then hope someone else buys you out, I think. But then the big energy companies, which is energy suppliers, just like, no, we're totally uninterested in buying you lot out. And I think that's where one of the problems came in. People were like, oh, Fort's going to make a load of money from Man as His Dog Energy. I've just lumbered myself with a not very good business.
Yeah, clearly not. Helen, are more going to fall, do you think? Have we seen the worst of it? Is the situation going to get better? Are bills going to fall?
I don't think bills are going to fall anytime soon. I mean, it, by the way things are going, it seems likely that more probably will go. The price of gas isn't really going anywhere. I mean, perhaps we're starting to hit a situation where, you know, the smaller ones, as Simon says, have kind of dropped off. But I mean, there could well be more. I think it's difficult as well because there's not really much customers can do at this point to change things. I mean, we would normally say, you know, shop around, change your supplier, but at this point it's really just best to stick with your existing one and try and ride it out. I mean, you're not going to find a better deal elsewhere, so I mean, sadly the advice is probably just to sit tight.
You can go look this stuff up yourself if you want. So Ofgem has a page, wholesale market indicators, right? Just Google electricity prices UK and that'll take you to that page. And it's got gas prices, forward delivery contracts, and it's got electricity prices, forward delivery contracts. And the charts do just genuinely show like prices going, you know, pretty much straight up in the air. It's like looking at one of those Bitcoin charts or a Tesla share price chart. I mean, gas prices, forward delivery contracts, weekly average has gone from about £50 per therm up to maybe just under 125 at the moment, since that's from February through to November. And that's the end of November. You're not even actually into winter properly at the end of November. Whereas February is the like in winter kind of thing. And electricity prices again have gone from, you know, just over £50, so £53, up to £112.5. And actually that's the concern for people, is it was gas prices that absolutely rocketed, but electricity prices have been going a bit mad recently as well.
So I'm going to ask you, what will the big six, as they sit round thinking about all of this going on, what will they be thinking? Is this a good move for them? And I think that what will investors be thinking? What will the energy market look like? Let's ride it out 1, 2, 3, 5 years time. Would they be pleased by this turn of events? Will they be going, oh, I told you. Will we have, you know, one British Gas back and everyone else? I think my mum would be pleased about that. Everyone else fall by the wayside? I mean,
at the rate we're going, we'll just end up with one supplier. We'll be back to the old British Gas.
Would that be so bad, Simon? I say that with no intent at all, but would that be such a bad thing? Explain why it might.
Wouldn't really be like the old British Gas, because British Gas had the supply and the grid and things like that, and that's all been split up since. But it would be bad because you do need an element of competition but you need the competition not to be totally artificial. And I think that some of the competition that was going on was artificial. It was deck chair shuffling stuff. I think that we will end up with a much smaller energy market. We'll probably end up with a better run energy market off the back of some of this stuff that Ofgem is talking about doing. And it is doing stuff. So, you know, to be fair to them. And I think that we will end up with an element of competition. It just won't be the same kind of competition and switching, you know, switch here, switch there, switch now kind of stuff that we previously had. You know, that said, until this happened, it was very true that if you had not switched energy supplier, you could save yourselves about £300 or £400 a month, depending on what property you live in and everything like that. And you can't really switch at the moment because it's not meaningful, and you might end up switching onto something that's more expensive. But once this settles down, it will probably still be worth switching and keeping an eye on your bills, because as we all know, sticking with the same company is rarely a rewarding experience.
Indeed. All right then, finally, if Omicron and Boris aren't putting enough of a dampener on Christmas, inflation is there just to kick the boot in. In-demand presents surging in price and selling out thanks to delivery bottlenecks and all sorts of problems. Simon, what are all sorts of problems? What's going on?
What are all sorts of problems? Yes. Do you want a list?
Yeah, go on.
Okay.
As long as it's an entertaining list. Right. Do it in a fun, friendly way and explain why I can't get a Barbie. Should I want one? I don't know what else is running out. Marmite, but I don't tend not to give Marmite as a gift for Christmas.
I'm trying to wonder how you start a fun and entertaining list with the word COVID, right? But I'm going to give it a try, okay? So okay, COVID, you know, that crazy thing turned our lives upside down. Well, you know, now it means you have to pay more for speakers and VR goggles at Christmas and Barbies, but maybe just don't get them a Barbie anyway, because who wants a Barbie? Although if you've ever seen the TV program, it's quite ironic and mildly funny. Although I still convince my daughters that they should never watch Barbie, the TV program.
I did wonder then why.
Watch Teen Titans Go instead, guys. That has a financial aspect to it quite often.
If anybody else doesn't know what Simon's talking about.
No, it's great. Teen Titans Go is brilliant. Sometimes I'll just be sitting there and I'm just overhearing the TV in the distance, and all of a sudden one of the characters is talking about interest rates and explaining it in quite a funny way that's also quite accurate. And I'm like, what are you watching?
They're teaching them interest rates on kids' TV.
Yeah, tell me
this
about
is where
it.
Boris went wrong. He went with Peppa Pig. He was wrong. Teen Titans is where it's at. Teen Titans, yeah. Anyway, we get distracted there, Simon. Stuff is going on, but I'm entertained.
Right,
well
okay.
Done.
So huge global disruption to supply chains and delivery networks has meant that the knock-on effect is this sort of stop-go, suddenly stuff isn't there, suddenly it arrives in a glut. One day you walk into the co-op and the entire meat fridge has been filled with bottles of salad cream and brown sauce to cover up the fact that they have no food in the fridge. The next week you walk in and it's full of meat again, and the salad cream's gone from the fridge. It's that kind of crazy stuff going on. And it means that things that are in high demand can suddenly disappear, or things that are in high demand, people can suddenly ask more money for. Now, VR goggles. Who'd have thought that all of a sudden loads of people would want virtual reality goggles? They've been trying to push this stuff on people for absolute donkey's years.
2014, isn't it? Yeah.
It is. I think you're way back before then. The price of those is up 41%, apparently, according to this monitoring of popular Christmas presents. Speakers, you know, portable speakers. I mean, if ever there was a market where you would have thought it was not difficult to find something, it's the portable speaker market. The portable speaker market has gone absolutely bananas in recent years. Everybody does a portable speaker. There's portable speakers everywhere. Most of them are absolute rubbish. You'd be better off singing the song to yourself. But the price of those, up 29%. E-readers. I mean, I was under the understanding that e-readers were out and people were buying books again. Price of those up 24%. Dolls houses, again, not something you'd expect there to be a shortage of. Flick through the Argos catalogue for some old-fashioned present-picking joy and you won't see a shortage of dolls houses on offer. But apparently if you want to buy one, it'll cost you 28% more. Electric toothbrushes for the love of your life, perhaps, for Christmas. 21% more expensive Drones, 10% more expensive. Bread makers, only 5% more expensive. E-bikes, again, you think e-bikes, yeah, loads of people want e-bikes and people are buying them, but they're only 1% more expensive. It's, I mean, you look through the figures in Grace's article here, and it is a very much a sort of random effect of like stuff that's going up, stuff that isn't going up. So the ebook readers are up, price of that's up 24%, but the price of tablets, you know, tablets that you hold and use like a computer, is only up 7%. And you're like, well, how does that work? But unfortunately, every single number in here looks like quite an ugly number of like more than your wages are going up kind of number.
Is it because something like an e-reader perhaps is less popular than a laptop, and therefore if you have got a shortage of something or there are delivery problems, you're going to prioritize the thing that's going to sell the most?
Yeah, and some of this is to do with the chip shortage, okay, with some of the electronic products. Is lots of stuff have chips in and people can't get the chips at the moment. I mean, it's been very, very difficult to get laptops for quite a long period of time because, A, lots of them got bought up by companies suddenly getting people to work from home, or people who were suddenly working from home then buying a laptop. People bought up computers in lockdown because, like, well, I'm going to be stuck at home, I'm going to buy myself a new computer. You then had the chip shortage caused by them not being able to manufacture as many chips. And then all of a sudden there was this wave of demand for them, which has then led through to, they can't make enough new cars to sell to people. So the price of used cars has gone up massively. And they prioritized the electronics industry over the car industry. That has then sent car hire prices up massively because car hire companies rely on getting new cars, and they get a new car every year. We went into lockdown. Nobody wanted to hire a car because nobody was going on holiday. They were on the risk of going bust. They flogged off their fleets to get some money in on the basis they could just buy some more cars when they needed them. Went to try and buy more cars. They can't buy any cars because there's not enough to go around. And the car manufacturers are saying to them, well, we're not going to give you the cars. We're going to actually prioritize the individual customers because it'd be more damaging if we can't sell cars to them. And so car hire prices have gone up by like 100, 200%. There are some Christmas presents that have decreased in price, though. So I'll quickly run you through those.
Okay.
Perfumes, down 2%. Aftershaves also down 2%. Laptops down 23%. There you go. Crazy.
I've never got a laptop for Christmas.
Ooh, no, I know. But popcorn machines, down 24%.
No one of those.
Piano keyboards, down 19%. Lego, down 2%. Games consoles, apparently on average, down 24%. And e-scooters, should you wish to present your friends and family with a wonderful opportunity to injure themselves before the end of the holidays,
and
they
others,
are 7% cheaper. Yeah.
I'm rather liking the sound of the keyboard. I can't play it, but it seems interesting nonetheless. What about socks? Socks? Scented candles? What other classics do we get at Christmas? Helen, how can we keep the cost of Crimbo down?
I mean, it seems
apart from
like
buying everyone, you know, electric scooters, which I don't think are that cheap anyway, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like it's all electronics and toys. So, I mean, maybe don't buy those things, and not really helpful if you have kind of children. I'm
sorry,
lucky that
kids, here's some perfume.
Yeah, sorry.
Appreciate it being older. Like, it still smells all right.
Yeah, a pair of pajamas maybe. I mean, I don't know. I part of me thinks that Christmas presents and the whole sort of culture around going crazy spending might be a bit different this year. I know among people that I know, I think it seems like people are a bit more chilled out about it. Having not really done anything for Christmas last year, I think some people are saying, look, hopefully we can at least spend time together, and maybe buying each other a bunch of stuff we don't really need is not something we need to get into as much. Is that just me being too idealistic? I don't know. I'm certainly not as fussed about receiving or giving particularly extravagant Christmas presents this year. I just, you know, a book here, a pair of socks
might
there.
Be an
I
age
think
thing,
it's
maybe.
Fine. Maybe.
I
yeah. I don't
I say
know.
That, but my sister suggested doing Secret Santa. Whew, no. No, I haven't none of that. What's that
no?
about? Secret
but then
Santa?
You only have to buy one present, though.
But that's not the point of gifting. The point of gifting is because you want to give someone to, I guess, tell them you love them or something. I don't know what the point of gifting is, because they write a list and they want a pair of socks or whatever they want.
True, but does anyone ever get anything they actually want without asking for it? That's the ideal of giving a present, isn't it? You know, something so thoughtful and so perfect. But I mean, is it ever really? I don't think so. I'm just super ungrateful.
No, Helen, not at all. It's about giving yourself at Christmas, isn't it? It's about who's round the tree, not what's... Oh, shut up, Georgie. Right, you can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. If you have any comments or questions for the team, anything you'd like them to look into, or any random Christmas presents you've ever got, or the perfect Christmas presents you've ever received that you've loved for longer than, you know, a couple of days. Simon?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney, or you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcast past and join in the debate and read the comments. And the only thing I'd say on Christmas presents is make the effort to go out and spend some money in independent shops, okay? Whether you do it in local independent shops, whether you do it online for independent shops, don't just give all your money to Amazon or the massive retailers. I mean, even with something like books, spend the money at Waterstones, don't spend the money at Amazon. Give these guys the help that they need. It's been another tough year for them. It's just tough in general. But there's loads of really great independent businesses out there. So try and give them some of your money. You know, when you're buying stuff for Christmas, maybe go to the butchers instead of the supermarket for some of it. The greengrocers, the whatever. Just try and spend some money locally. And a good tip, if you're buying books, is there are a couple of websites. One's called hive.co.uk, and there's a rival which I think has come over from the US called bookshop.org, and they let you buy books online for people, but they source them from local bookshops.
Nice. So what's that? Hive and...
hive.co.uk and bookshop.org.
Marvelous.
Give one of them a try.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.